From the City of Angels near the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Later tonight, the coronavirus. Was it predicted by Billy Meyer? Here's what's happening. U.S. intelligence officials are telling some lawmakers that Russia is beginning to interfere in the 2020 election campaign by aiming to cast doubt on the integrity of the vote and boost President Donald Trump's re-election campaign. The person who spoke on a condition of anonymity because of the matter's sensitivity said the Trump's Republican allies on the Democratic-led House Intelligence Committee questioned the assessment presented by officials of the Office of National Intelligence. Well, we shall see. The federal judge has sentenced former President Donald Trump's longtime advisor Roger Stone to 3 years and 4 months in prison and said his lies to lawmakers investigating Russian interference in his 2016 U.S. presidential election posed a threat to American democracy. After U.S. District Judge Amy Berman Jackson sentenced the veteran Republican operative in Washington, President Trump indicated he has no immediate plans to pardon Stone and would let the legal process play out, while adding that at some point he'll make a determination. We contacted Roger Stone tonight. He's been on the program several times. He sent us a text that said he's under a court order, gag order, and he could not comment. Dr. Jerome Corsi, author of Partners in Crime, was with us. Jerry, your take on this whole situation with Roger Stone, you know him well.
Yes, I think millions of Americans tonight are really upset that, you know, you get a double standard of justice. You've got Andrew McCabe, for instance, in the Department of Justice, four times mentioned as having lied. This is in the Inspector General Horowitz's report, and he does not get prosecuted. And Roger Stone gets 40 months in prison for basically lying. This double standard of justice where anyone who's a Democrat or who is a, in a sense, leftist gets to walk, and Roger Stone gets pretty much a very severe criminal sentence is under this gag order, even while he's waiting the determination of whether or not there should be another trial, given the juror prejudice against him in D.C. I mean, the double standard of justice, I think, just stands out and is very offensive right now.
Now, do you think the president will pardon him? And if so, what do you think that does to his reelection campaign? How do people look at this?
I think that President Trump will wait and see what the ultimate outcome is. Roger Stone was let go on bond today, pending the determination of another trial. That determination has to be made by Judge Amy Jackson Berman soon. I think President Trump will pardon Roger Stone and probably should. And, George, I quite frankly don't think it'll affect his reelection. I think people are offended by Roger Stone being convicted of this double standard of justice, and I think President Trump is also offended. But he'll wait until it's a appropriate time to take a step. I don't think Roger Stone is going to be in prison for 40 months. I think this is wrong, and I think President Trump will intervene.
Jerry, we've had 3.5 years of nothing but chaos surrounding this administration, battles in court and everything else. When are we going to be able to just run this country like a country?
Well, the Democrats have never accepted the result of the 2016 election. We've had not only from day one resistance, and including even today, Adam Schiff in the House of Representatives, a Democrat who brought the impeachment, is saying again, if President Trump were to pardon Roger Stone, that would be an indication of obstruction of justice because Roger Stone was protecting Donald Trump. I think that the American people are tired of this. We have an election in November, and I believe the American people believe that the election is the way to determine who's going to be the next president. And this constant resistance, I think, only is a detriment to the Democrats, not to the Republicans.
All right, Jerry, thank you so much. Dr. Jerry Corsi. Stocks keep reaching record highs. Goldman Sachs is worried that leaving investors vulnerable to surprises. The investment bank told clients this week that a near-term correction in which the market slides at least 10% from a recent peak is looking much more probable. So just take heed. Researchers at the National Institute of Health and the University of Texas at Austin claim they've made a breakthrough in their coronavirus research and said the data could help to develop a vaccine. The commanding officer of the U.S. Navy supercarrier, the USS Nimitz, has revealed his crew has an obligation to make sure the airspace is clear of UFOs. In an exclusive interview with the Daily Mail, Captain Mark Clark said it's important that his ship and everybody on it kept safe from unidentified aerial phenomenon, the term the UFOs are used by the Navy. He did not say they're extraterrestrial, however. This comes just weeks after the Office of Naval Intelligence revealed the existence of a classified, unreleased video relating to the Nimitz carrier group's 2004 encounters with that tic-tac-shaped UFO. What else is going on in the skies? Let's check in with the weekly report from Peter Davenport from the National UFO Reporting Center. Go ahead, Peter.
That's a really interesting statement from the captain of the Nimitz.
I'm sure is.
To see things breaking open a little bit, George. But as you know, both you and I have commented several times recently about these trains of orbiting Starlink satellites that are making the news, and I'm not going to dwell on them again. I've talked about them several times, but I would like to comment that I believe they're now things that are appearing, at least over the last week, have appeared in the skies above the United States that at first blush appear to be these satellites, but upon further investigation appear to be quite something else. And that leads me to my first report that I'd like to share with the Coast audience tonight. It was submitted last Sunday, the 16th of February. A gentleman describes that at 8:15 p.m. Sunday night, he and his girlfriend were outside in Waxahachie, Texas, enjoying the night sky, when all of a sudden their attention was drawn to a cluster, a wedge-shaped cluster of what they estimated to be about 20 low-flying, elongated, he calls them arrowhead-shaped objects. There were between 20 and 25, he estimates. They formed a formation, he called it a flattened V-shaped formation. And each object, interestingly, looked to have it was like an elongated arrowhead, very long and tapered, and it had a distinct chunk out of the back of it. It was a recessed trailing edge to it. He said they tried to get pictures, but they were so stunned they couldn't get their cameras out quickly enough to get a picture of it. The next case I'd like to talk about comes from Bend, Oregon. This is last night, George, at 10:38 p.m. Pacific time. Two gentlemen were standing outside with night vision devices looking for things to examine in the night sky, moving objects to examine in the night sky. One of them had a 2-watt blue laser for pointing objects out to his viewing friend. And suddenly his friend exclaimed, "Look to the south." He looked up and they both saw a cluster of objects streaking from south to north. The gentleman holding the laser reports that he illuminated, he flashed it at the formation of objects, and suddenly, instantly, like an explosive force, they all separated from one another and went off in different directions. Very interesting report. Last two reports come, first one comes from Santee, California, near Miramar Naval Air Station. A gentleman writes that he was taking the trash out yesterday, and he saw two F-35 brand new fighter aircraft pursuing three round objects below solid overcast, or below the haze level, and the three objects, round objects, suddenly split up instantly and streaked off in different directions. They later, in the sighting, came back. I'll have this report together with the rest of them posted to the website.
Right.
People can read the details. And last report comes from Temecula, California. This afternoon at 12:30 p.m. Pacific time, a young woman writes that she saw two round objects circling one another overhead, and they suddenly split up and went in different directions. So a lot's going on, George, and I'll save the rest of it for next week.
Talk to you next Friday. Peter Davenport from the National UFO Reporting Center. Up next, Randall Carlson joins us as we talk about ancient cataclysms and sacred geometry next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. Randall Carlson is a master builder, architectural designer, teacher, geomythologist, geological explorer, and a scholar. And he has 4 decades of study, research, and exploration into the interface between ancient mysteries and modern science. He's been an active Freemason for more than 40 years. Is a past master of one of the oldest and largest Masonic lodges in Georgia. Randall, you were with us about 3 years ago with Jimmy Church. Welcome back.
Oh, great to be back, George. Huh? Yes, I was. Has it already been 3 years?
It's going to be 3 years in March. Can you believe that?
Oh, my gosh. I mean, I'm 3 years older now than when I was talking to Jimmy.
Yeah, you sure are. Jimmy has a way of aging people.
I guess that's what it is, or accelerating time.
That's right. Absolutely. Yeah. Hey, tell me a little bit more about yourself other than the bio. How'd you get into all this?
Oh, gosh. That goes back, you know, to being a kid, growing up, you know, with a fascination in astronomy and in the outdoors, things like that. Grew up in rural Minnesota. So, you know, we had a really splendid view of the night sky. So really early on, I can remember being probably 4 or 5 years old, going out with my dad, learning how to recognize the Big Dipper and Orion and all of this. And I guess it started with that. And then, you know, where I lived was right on the edge of what is called the Laurentide Ice Sheet, which was the great ice sheet that covered North America during the Ice Age. So I was surrounded by hills and lakes and things that had been sculpted by the great ice sheets, and I can still remember, I think I was 7. My dad showed me some pictures in a book and I wish I could remember what the book was, but it was describing, you know, how the ice came down and it moved boulders.
Mm-hmm.
And it left all the lakes behind in Minnesota, you know, 15,000 lakes estimated in Minnesota, maybe another 10,000 next door in Wisconsin. But of course, all of those lakes are the meltwater puddles that were left over after the melting of the great ice sheet. So, I mean, it has its roots there, but I could say that in the summer of 1970, I spent the whole summer pretty much hiking and camping in the western states, which included Colorado and Idaho and Montana, Oregon, Washington, and I really kind of just got very much obsessed with geology. Wanted to understand the landscapes that were so fascinating to me, and I felt that I kind of intuited that there was a story there. And it wasn't probably for another 10 years that I actually began to understand the specifics and the details of that story, because that summer, really, it gestated in my mind, and I had a lot of other things going on there in the 70s. And then late 70s, I met somebody who was researching catastrophism. I think it was 77 or 78. It was actually when I went into Freemasonry. It was a gentleman in my lodge, and he was doing a lot of research into ancient climate change.
Mm-hmm.
And geological change and these kinds of things. He had been studying the author Charles Hapgood, who was one of the early proponents of a crustal shift, you know, a polar shift. And he had a book called Path of the Pole. I think it came out in 76 or 77. And I read the book, and he had a bibliography in there of, gosh, I don't know, 300 or more references. And I got so fascinated by that I set out over the next year or two to track down every single one of those references. And I did not succeed, but I probably got 90% of them. I was also interested in mythology. So one of the things, you know, if you get immersed into mythology, you quickly discover that there is catastrophism all throughout
right. The
world's great.
And you get hooked on it, too.
And you get hooked on it. And then when you begin to see that, wait a second, you know, the modern geologists and document the people who are documenting the changes in the global landscape and so on really are just using different language, but they're in effect telling the same story as the story that has come down to us through the myths and the legends and the folklore and so on. So making that connection was really interesting and exciting to me, and just cemented my interest in it. So going into the 80s, I just spent all my spare time when I wasn't building things, studying geology and astronomy, and then came to, you know, the realization that the two domains really had an intimate connection with one another. And one of the things that, I'll jump backwards, I was one of those boys in the 50s that was utterly obsessed with dinosaurs. And
you had little models and everything else.
Oh,
I did too.
Oh, I had the models and yes, I did. And would watch any movie or show that had dinosaurs on it. You know, I was obsessed literally until my teenage years. And then I think I got more maybe interested in girls or something.
Favorite dinosaur was what?
My favorite dinosaur was obviously T-Rex.
Me too. Same thing.
Obviously the T-Rex. Yeah, I like the T-Rex. And, of course, yeah. So one of the things, you know, I had, who knows, four or five books on dinosaurs. They all talked about the mystery of the disappearance of the dinosaurs. What happened to them, you know? Well, so that was kind of an idea that was planted in my mind. And then 1980, pivotal year for study of Earth history, there was three independent teams, all who had been looking at the mystery of the sudden disappearance of the dinosaurs and had come to the conclusion that it was extraterrestrial in nature. And the Alvarez team was probably the most well-known, who discovered that there was this iridium layer separating the Cretaceous period from the Tertiary period, which was, you know, 65 million years ago. And iridium is a signature of something cosmic, likely an asteroid impact or a comet impact that can deliver these rare elements that are rare on the surface of the Earth. Now, iridium is called a siderophile because it loves iron. And the assumption is that the absence of iridium or other platinum group metals in the Earth's crust is because they bonded with iron and then sank towards the Earth's core, depleting the Earth's crust. So when you find an enhancement or a spike of iridium in the Earth's crust, in the rocks, there's a likely explanation for it. And so they found the iridium at this outcrop in Gubbio, Italy, and it was enhanced by about 100 times over the background count of iridium. So they speculated, well, gosh, maybe there was some kind of an extraterrestrial event associated with this level that marks this demise of the dinosaurs. So they began to look at samples from KT, or Cretaceous Tertiary outcrops, from all around the rest of the world. And over the next few years, dozens and dozens of sites were examined by them and other teams. And at every one they looked at, what they discovered was there was this iridium spike. So it became apparent that the whole planet had been blanketed by this cosmic material. Well, so where does that lead us? It leads us into the idea of celestial impacts. So when that came out, I was just electrified, and it reignited my interest in dinosaurs and really cemented my fascination with catastrophism, because it was like two areas now that I really loved, which was astronomy and geology, were suddenly coming together in a really kind of a unique way. See, that this idea now that the cosmos has played a critical role in the evolution and the history of the Earth, to me, it's an extremely profound idea.
And you've used this word catastrophism a couple times. Explain that.
Well, catastrophism is the name that really that goes back to the founding days of geology. I would say like pre-Civil War, early 1820s, 1830s, really up to about the 1880s, you would consider the founding days of geology. And you had these gentlemen, like Adam Sedgwick is a good example. He was a theologian who was making his rounds to preach the gospel, but he also had an interest in science. So he was English, and he would travel around the countryside, and he was also a keen observer. So he would notice these deposits and these sudden changes in the rock layers or sudden changes in the types of fossils that are preserved in the rocks. He concluded that there had been catastrophes or sudden interruptions in the history of the Earth. One of the things he was looking at was glacial deposits, which he interpreted as being flood deposits. Well, being a theologian, you can probably imagine what flood he was conjuring up.
Exactly. Hold on for a second, Randall. We'll come back and pick it up at the flood in just a moment. Randall's websites are linked up at coasttocoastam.com. Randall Carlson with us as we're talking about ancient cataclysms. Could they happen again? We'll be back. And welcome back to Coast. George Norrie with you, back with Randall Carlson as we talk about ancient cataclysms that could happen now. Randall, you were talking about the Great Flood, I believe.
Yeah, that's kind of where we left it. We had just talked about how Adam Sedgwick had been traveling around England and seeing deposits that he initially believed to be the result of Noah's flood. He later, though, about a decade later, he did change his mind and came to believe that, the flood deposits were actually more local or regional rather than a global flood. But he was one of the founding fathers of he never did necessarily abandon his lens of catastrophism that he looked at by which he looked at global change. Then there was Roderick Murchison. He was also about contemporary with Adam Sedgwick. He was a catastrophist. We say a catastrophist because they believed that there were great sweeping catastrophes in the history of the earth. Georges Cuvier, considered to be the founder of paleontology, he was a catastrophist. And that was mainly because of his studies of the fossil record, because he would find that there were, you know, places in the rock where there was abundant fossils preserved, and then an overlying rock was just almost totally barren in fossils. So he would, well, what happened here? Why did these fossils disappear?
Were they concerned it would happen again?
Well, I don't necessarily think that they thought that it would happen again in their lifetimes. I think that they were, you know, they were more concerned with the interpreting events of the past, and so they were putting it in that framework. Now, I don't know, maybe Sedgwick, being a theologian, maybe he had apocalyptic ideas that there was going to be another global catastrophe. I'm not sure about that. But what happened was a lot of these guys initially looked at this evidence, thought that it was great floods. Then you had, well, Louis Agassiz was basically is considered the godfather of glacier studies. And he came along and showed that a lot of the things that they were looking at that they thought were flood deposits were actually glacial deposits. And he came to America post-Civil War and helped to establish this idea of recognizing glacially created landscapes. So what then happened was they kind of, geology, you see, at this point is not an academic discipline. It's not being taught as such in universities. That didn't come until the 1890s and into the early 20th centuries, where geology actually became a scholastic discipline with dogmas. See, once those dogmas got entrenched, the dogmas replaced the ideas of catastrophe mm-hmm. with the ideas of uniformity. And this came along with primarily James Hutton and Charles Lyell and Charles Darwin. Because
Darwin was involved in this too, huh?
Well, yes, because Darwin originally had looked at a lot of the evidence when he was traveling in the Beagle, determined that there had to have been great sweeping catastrophes to explain the evidence that he was looking at. But in the end, he abandoned the idea because it was just too extreme for him. But think about Darwinism. It's basically based upon the idea of slow, gradual, accumulated, incremental changes. And that's exactly the uniformity idea of geology. And so once they got away from the idea of a young Earth, a 6,000-year-old Earth, and began to admit or recognize that the Earth was, you know, actually millions of years old, well, now it's like, okay, well, the features that are that we observe in the Earth now, they could be created over many, many millions of years. And we don't need to compress these events into a very short span of time.
How about billions of years, Randall?
Well, even billions of years. But, of course, they're not thinking billions of years yet in the 19th century. They're just thinking.
They're not. Okay.
They're still thinking millions. I think it was Lord Kelvin that did some studies in radioactivity, came up, I think it was around 70 million years. So then that became part of the dogma for a while. But then as we get into the 20th century, you know, then, yeah, we've moved certainly into billions of years now, I think 4.6 billion years. But they kind of threw the baby out with the bathwater, because once geology became established as an academic discipline, uniformity, gradualism became the dominant paradigm. And anything outside of that was looked upon with disfavor because, oh, you're trying to bring back in biblical literalism, you're trying to bring back Noah's flood, et cetera, et cetera. So we don't need that anymore. So fast forward a couple of decades to the 1920s. You now have a geologist by the name of J. Harlan Bretz, who is studying landscapes up in eastern Washington. And all the evidence that he's amassing and looking at leads him to believe that there was these gigantic floods that swept over eastern Washington. When he proposed some of these ideas in the mainstream literature, scientific literature of the 1920s, he was attacked mercilessly by the defenders of gradualism, because they basically said, you're trying to take us back to biblical literalism. We don't need giant floods to explain the landscapes or the rock layers, the stratigraphy. We don't need that. So he encountered a great deal of resistance to these ideas, but he stuck to it for about 20, 25 years, kept amassing more and more data that just made a overwhelmingly convincing case that these huge floods had swept across eastern Washington. And it was gradually accepted, but not really fully accepted by the geological community until the 1960s. At that point, one of the principal critics of J. Harlan Bretz was actually persuaded to come out in the field for a week, which he had never done. And he came out, spent a week in the field looking at the evidence before his eyes in the landscape, and at the end of that week, he was standing in front of a feature called Palouse Falls in southeastern Washington, where there is this gigantic horseshoe-shaped cataract with a little trickle of water, which is the modern Palouse River,
mm-hmm.
and the accumulated effect of this week of looking at day after day, this mega-scale evidence. He finally comes back to the group after standing looking at this one particular feature for many minutes, comes walking back, and he says, how could I have been so wrong? And that was a beginning of the turning point. And just like what happened in the 1980s when it was accepted that an extraterrestrial impact had actually occurred, that was a turning point. With J. Harlan Bretz in the 20s and the 30s, that became a turning point, although it didn't really manifest until the 60s. And then you had a new generation of geologists coming up in the 1970s and 1980s that were now willing to accept the idea that, yes, these are these giant floods that occurred. Now, what's the explanation? And the original objections to the flood theories in the 20s and 30s of Harlan Bretz was, well, you can't explain a source of water so great, therefore there were no floods like you're talking about. So that kind of became the modus operandi by the 60s and 70s, was the effort to explain what could have caused floods. And we're talking about floods that were measured in hundreds of millions of cubic feet per second.
Are these like biblical floods, Randall?
Well, I could call them biblical scale floods from this standpoint. Anyone who managed to survive one by some sheer luck of the draw could easily believe that the entire world had been destroyed.
Of course, especially in your location. That's all you saw and knew.
Yes. Now, not biblical in the simple-minded sense that the whole world is supernaturally drowned with water all the way
brought on by God to exterminate the population at the time.
Right. But, like you just said, George, you could, a survivor could, and for generations, descendants might grow up, live, die, and not know that there were other people in the world. Because if you're talking about an area, let's say, the size of several states that's completely wiped out.
Yeah, and that's all they knew.
That's all they knew. Yes, that's exactly right. So we've come a long way since then, because now what has happened is these, as they're called, the channel scab lands are the erosional features in eastern Washington. Generally, the name given to the flood is the Missoula floods, because they emanated from a series of deep basins within the Rocky Mountains of western Montana and the Bitterroot Mountains.
Are these the mega floods that you've talked about?
These are the mega floods that I've talked about, although we now know that there are evidence for mega floods all over the earth.
Exactly.
Not a single flood necessarily. I'm not talking about that. But mega floods that would be measured in tens to hundreds of millions of cubic feet per second. And these are phenomenal. Well, consider where Spokane, Washington is, the flow right through that area was estimated to be between 700 and 800 million cubic feet per second. Now, the largest known measured flood in North America was the Great Flood, Mississippi, of 1993, that topped out at about 1.2 million.
I was there in St. Louis.
Okay, so you know that.
I saw that.
You saw that. Now, try to imagine that flood times 700 or 800 times as big.
Oh, my God. Huge.
That's the scale we're talking about here,
George. I mean, buildings were underwater. It was that high.
It was that high. Well, there are places in Washington, in the panhandle of Idaho, right there where the Clark Fork River, if anybody wants to look on maps, the Clark Fork River comes out of western Montana, dumps into Lake Pendere. In that valley, the water was 2,100 feet deep.
Yeah, that's like an ocean.
That's like an ocean. And in fact, the unit of measure that the geologists and the paleohydrologists use to talk about these floods is the Sverdrup, which is actually developed by oceanographers to talk about the great ocean currents like the Gulf Stream. And it's basically a million cubic meters per second. So they talk about Sverdrups. And one of the, like this flood there by Spokane, if you took, George, to get another sense of the scale of thing, if you took every river on Earth, and you start thinking about that in North America, South America, Africa, Europe, Asia, every single river on Earth, and added those flows together, you're still only 1/10 to 1/20 the size of these maximum flows that occurred. So, to me, the question of the cause of the floods, see, the geological community has kind of closed around this idea of an ice dam. I reject that idea for many reasons, and I think that the cause of the floods is actually accelerated melting of the great ice sheets, which was J. Harlan Brett's original idea, but which he abandoned because everybody attacked him for that and said, you can't explain how you're going to get that much melting that fast.
And when would that melting have occurred?
This would have occurred roughly between somewhere, the dates are usually putting it at between 12 and 14,000 years ago.
Now, the Younger Dryas is a rapid cooling period. That was around then, too, wasn't it?
Yes. Good connection.
What came first?
It appears. Now, here's where it gets a little complicated. It appears that there were three great melting events that ultimately brought down the ice sheets. And, you know, those ice sheets that we're talking about, if you took all of the South Polar ice sheet and all of the Greenland ice sheet and put over upper North America, it still wouldn't be as much ice as reached from the Atlantic to the Pacific and from the northern United States up into Canada, to the Arctic Circle. Was maybe as much as 2 miles thick in the area of Hudson.
Oh, they'd cover skyscrapers, wouldn't they?
Oh, absolutely cover skyscrapers. You know, some of the tallest buildings on Earth are what, a couple of thousand? No, not even that. I think the tallest building in Atlanta here is about 1,200 feet high.
Jeez.
So, yeah, I don't know. What's the new World Trade Center building? That's what, 1,776 feet high, right? So if this building was in that Clark Fork River Valley of northern Idaho, there would still be 400 feet of water over the top of it. So
by the way, the tallest building's 2,700 feet in Abu Dhabi or Dubai.
2,700 feet. So you would have had 600 feet of that upper 600 feet of that building then would be above water. But of course, this is water that's moving 50 or 60 miles an hour, so that building wouldn't last.
It would knock it down, wouldn't it?
Oh, yeah, it would totally knock it down, wash it away, and obliterate it utterly.
Are you concerned that this could happen again to us?
Well, that wouldn't necessarily happen because we don't have the great buildup. You know, we don't have 6 million cubic miles of ice.
No, not yet anyway.
Not yet. Now, I believe that we have to look at an extraterrestrial factor here to explain what happened.
Well, on this program, when you say extraterrestrial, you better clarify yourself.
Yes, I mean probably an imp. First and foremost, to be the impact of an asteroid or a comet, or in the case of the Younger Dryas, now that has abundant evidence accumulating that it was a cosmic impact. It looks like to have been a disintegrating comet that the Earth encountered around 12,900 years ago, give or take a half a century. And so that's what I mean by extraterrestrial. I don't necessarily mean UFOs in this case. As a secondary possibility, I would look at the sun and maybe hyperactive solar activity. The thing is, the Younger Dryas boundary is now showing impact proxies in abundance. What that means is you're finding microspherals and magnetic grains, and the iridium spike has been found in the Greenland ice cores dating to 12,900 years ago, a platinum spike, an osmium spike. These are all platinum group elements that, again, are delivered to Earth via meteorites, asteroids, and comets. And, yeah, there's an abundant amount of evidence that suggests that Earth had some kind of a cosmic encounter. Now, the thing is that there was apparently three great melting episodes that were required to mostly get rid of the ice sheets. The earliest one, unless there are adjustments to the radiocarbon dating, the earliest one looks like it was at 14,600 years ago.
Well, that's, really in times of Earth time, that's not much.
No, that's not much at all. And what makes that significant is because throughout all this time, we modern humans and our ancestors were here on Earth living through this stuff.
About 15 generations.
Yeah, that's probably about right. Yeah. So then you have this event at 12,900 that apparently caused a lot of melting plus global wildfires, and then that was followed by the 1,300-year rapid cooling that you mentioned is called the Younger Dryas. And then when the Younger Dryas ended at 11,600 years ago, there was another warming spike associated with very rapid melting of the ice sheet.
What causes that warming spike? They didn't have factories and cars then.
No, well, you just hit that's the question. That's the $64,000 question, George, right there.
Yep.
What caused it? And I don't know, but that's what I've been obsessively researching, and I'm working with some very interesting people who are also researching that very
question. Are you getting close to an answer?
I think we're closer now than we were a decade ago, certainly. However, the more we look at this span of time, the more complicated it gets. So, you know, one of the things that's come out recently with a lot of the solar observations that have been going on since the 90s is the sun is much more active than previously assumed.
Precisely.
And a lot of this information about hyperactive sun is not getting into the, you know, the computer models of climate change that we're constantly being barraged with.
Hold on for a second, Randall. We're at the top of the hour. When we come back, I want to chat some more about your work, and also we'll open up the phone lines and take phone calls from our amazing listeners on Coast to Coast AM.